A very special guest joining us in studio this afternoon. We are so thrilled to have her here, a pioneering rock music journalist, a poet, the former poet laureate of Belfast, a radio host. She has done it all in her time, and now either caps her career or it's the beginning of the end, as Ellen Sander joins us in studio. Ellen, thank you so much for being with us.
I'm very excited to be here.
We appreciate you making the trip up with Bruce today. How long have you two known each other?
Three lifetimes.
it's a couple of years anyway.
I moved to Belfast in 2006, and I think I met you my first year.
Yes, right. I think at a poet's speak or something up here. Yes, right. So, yeah, it's been since 2006. Wow.
Well, we're so happy to have you here. You've been getting a lot of well-deserved publicity lately, featured in Rolling Stone for, I don't want to say the re-release, but the release of the augmented edition of your classic book, Trips, Rock Life in the 60s. How did this new and improved version come to pass?
They called me.
Perfect.
I literally, every 7 or 8 years, would shop it with no results. You know, so sometimes I wouldn't even get a rejection letter. I just wouldn't hear for 6 months. So, you know, and these people called me. And I think what happened, although I'm not for sure, there was an anthology called Shake It Up of rock journalism that came out, and it had a piece of mine in it. And I think the climate with the Me Too movement and the gender inequality, people would pick up on my piece that they included in the anthology. And so it got mentioned in every review. And I think that's how it came to the Dover editor's attention. And he said, you know, if you're interested, we want to republish it. And so I said, I'm an idiot, right? I said, well, I think I'd like to do a little more, you know, writing or maybe an interlocutory kind of wrap-up or something and add a couple things, take a couple things out. And they said, sure, but no more money. I went, oh, no, I think it's really worth doing it. So I did like five times the work for the same money. They would have just, you know, reissued it. But I'm really glad that I put the extra work into it and I got a chance to comment on what I had written before, because I didn't want to change a lot of it, because it had the voice of that time.
Right.
And even though I feel like I'm a better writer now, I just felt like keeping that voice was important.
Some new material as well that we'll talk about a little bit later, but I want to go back to really the beginning of the book, because to do what you've done, you came around at pretty much the absolute perfect time, coming of age and growing up in the 1950s when, as you point out in the opening chapter, it's almost the decade that invented the concept of teenagers.
Yes. Well, it was the demographics, too. I mean, it was a very, very big crop of teenagers, thanks to World War II. And somehow, without there ever being any writing about that, or you could feel the power of the generation, the power in numbers. And what motivated that, what ignited that, was the music.
Yeah, music aimed at that specific audience, because before that, if you pre-rock and roll, you listened to whatever your parents were listening to.
I listened to that television program, The Hit Parade, with Perry Como, and I can't remember the other people, but I loved that music, and I loved Perry Como, and, you know, Catch a Falling Star and Put It in Your Pocket. But when the music started to be made by teenagers themselves, that was important. That was something to respond to, and the response was immediate and very, very powerful.
Now, we were talking before we came on the air, music journalism, particularly rock music journalism, simply didn't exist in the early 1960s, and to even suggest that to publishers was head-scratching to them. How did that change? Was there a seminal moment that made them appreciate music, particularly rock music, as its own distinct art form?
I think it was the money. I think, you know, I think the advertising department said, like, 1 million people bought that album. They could read us. They don't read us now. So I actually think that's what it was.
Well, money talks, right, Bruce?
Yeah, absolutely. We were also talking before about your first long-form piece. If you could, I, th- I think that's a fascinating story. If you could share that with the listeners, that would
okay.
be great.
But I'd also like to add this side note that there were like little pulp magazines that were dedicated to rock and roll that had been around for a while, through which I and a number of other journalists that became successful in the mainstream media came up. I mean, I wrote for Hit Parader and I wrote for Circus. So I went to the Saturday Review and I had been referred over there, and I wrote a piece about an artist in a record. I don't even remember what it was. And they liked the writing and they said, why don't you do a piece that gives an idea of the whole landscape of this new rock and roll? And I said, well, it'll probably be pretty long. They said, well, you know, do it the way you think it should be done. So I came in with a 10,000 word piece and they went, maybe we could cut it in half and run it in two different issues. I said, no, you can't do that. It's hierarchical. And they went, okay. Because I guess I said it in such a way that, you know, was going to like hold the piece if they didn't do it. I don't know where, more guts than brains, I guess. So they actually ran the whole piece, 10,000 words of it, but they had to use the smallest type they had ever used. And they got such an enormous reaction, both pro and con, from it that they wanted to continue and asked me for a piece every month.
Now, as we said, there weren't a lot of people doing this. There were even fewer women doing this in the 1960s. What was it about you that earned the trust of the musicians and enabled you to get the access that you had?
I think because I was hanging out in Greenwich Village, and I would meet them, because when they would come into town to play concerts, that's where they would have their dinners. That's where the Fillmore East was downtown, and other venues. So I actually had been hanging out there for a while. So I was part of the crowd of some of those restaurants and bars, and just naturally started conversations, and they turned into articles and interviews and reviews.
Well, you have been everywhere, as we were saying before we came on the air, at seemingly every major music event of the 60s. Ellen, you were there. You knew everybody in rock and roll. I wonder if we could just throw out a few names and share some of your thoughts and memories about some of these folks.
That'd be fun.
And I want to start with one that might not come up right away, but somebody I like a lot and am fascinated by their work. Can you talk a little bit about Fred Neil?
Oh, Fred Neil was, he hung around the village, and every musician in town would go to hear Fred Neil sing, because he had such a beautiful voice and such beautiful intonation on the guitar, and he was like a mentor. He was also kind of very spaced out, but he and he spent a lot of his time in Florida as well. So he was a wonderful presence in Greenwich Village. He wasn't really a folk singer; he was really a jazz singer, but he taught everybody there.
And best known for writing Everybody's Talking, that became a
yes.
huge hit for Harry Nilsson.
Yes.
Someone else that you knew very well and you credit in the book for being so open, and someone that I don't think gets enough respect as we look back at rock music history, and that's Cass Elliott.
Oh, Cass was just amazing. I didn't know her very well. I just had that one interview with her, and that was after I had a name. But we had the most wonderful conversation, and she was such a down-to-earth person. She just wanted to talk about her child and the way her life was, and how she, you know, didn't want to get dressed up and put a lot of makeup on just to go out to buy groceries. She wanted to buy her own groceries because nobody would buy the ones that she wanted. So, I mean, the whole conversation was just about life. And also she had a lot of interesting thoughts about making it in the business as a woman. She felt like a lot of decisions were made over her head, that even if people would discuss them with her, they wouldn't take her advice. And when she went solo, she got all the wrong advice, and that didn't work out. But particularly in the group, since Michelle was married to John, Michelle's opinion would come above hers. And I really think that she was the best musician in the group. She had a fantastic voice and a fantastic range of musical background.
A group that we certainly look back on fondly, but people who weren't there don't realize that they were seen in many ways as the American answer to the Beatles, and that's the Byrds.
The Byrds, yes. I mean, for me, the Byrds were the big light bulb as far as when rock and roll turned into rock, or when when folk music moved over, and even more than Dylan, because they took Dylan and made it into rock and roll. And to me, that was just the moment when I realized, oh my God, something enormous is happening.
We're talking with Ellen Sander here on Downtown. We'll take a little break, catch up on the weather. When we come back, well, we'll talk about Dylan Moore. We'll talk about the Stones, Monterey Pop, and much more. Ellen Sander joining us in studio this afternoon.